Pleasure to be with you. Again, we'd like to express our appreciation to those who are visiting with us. And again, there are some of you who are here for the very first time, and we're happy that you are. And we do look forward to having a chance to get to know you better. I'd like to read a few verses this morning as we begin from the 16th chapter of Mark's Gospel. Mark's Gospel in this chapter is reporting for us the discovery of Jesus' tomb, his empty tomb, by women on that first day of the week, some 2,000 years ago. The text says in verse 4, as they approached the tomb and observed that the stone was indeed rolled away from the tomb, the text says, and looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled away, although it was extremely large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting at the right wearing a white robe, and they were amazed. And he said to them, "Do not be amazed. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who has been crucified. He has risen. He is not here. Behold, here is the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he said to you." And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had gripped them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. I'd like to talk with you this morning, if I may, for just a few minutes, about some reactions to Jesus' resurrection, or to the reports of Jesus' resurrection. I think sometimes we don't think about that when we think about the recordings of the resurrection accounts of Jesus here. I think we sometimes focus in upon the facts of what happened here and there. And it might do us well to think about the way that people reacted to either the evidence of Jesus' resurrection or the reports from witnesses about Jesus' resurrection. I think there are some lessons that we can learn from all of that. The first reaction to Jesus' resurrection that I want to mention to you is one that I think just about everybody had, and that was shock. I don't care whether you're talking about the enemies of Jesus or whether you're talking about his disciples, even the closest of Jesus' disciples, they're all shocked by the reports of his resurrection or by the evidence of his resurrection, or in the case that we have just looked at here in Mark 16, by the emptiness of his tomb that would indicate his resurrection, and by what this young man that turns out to be an angel was reporting that he has been raised. It was a shocking thing to them. It was shocking because it was unexpected. And when I think about the unexpected and shocking nature of Jesus' resurrection, on one level, I think we can say that's understandable that people were surprised and shocked by this. Because the Old Testament scriptures, though they foretold the death and resurrection of the Messiah, did so in a rather oblique way, keeping it a mystery. It wasn't something that was just self-evident that that's what those Old Testament passages were talking about. It was something that God purposely veiled and kept a mystery, to use the language that the New Testament so often uses. And that mystery would be revealed when these events ultimately occurred. So there certainly is a sense in which the unexpected nature of Jesus' resurrection, and therefore the shocking nature of the reports of his resurrection, that's to be understood. But yet when it comes to Jesus' disciples, it's altogether a different thing. You read about Jesus' disciples being shocked by the resurrection of Jesus. In Luke 24 and verse 12, we read of Peter going to the tomb after the women have eventually reported this. And Peter observes the emptiness of the tomb, and the text says that he left the tomb and he was marveling at all this. And in verse 22, you read about the two men on the road to Emmaus, those two disciples. And constantly the text is talking about how they were amazed and astonished when Jesus finally appeared to them. And they recognized this as being Jesus. Or in verse 37, when Jesus Later that evening on that resurrection day, he appears to his disciples as they are there at the end of the day. And the text says they're still astonished by all this. They're still marveling about all of this. And the thing about that that is not understandable is the fact that Jesus had made his resurrection something perfectly clear and plain to his disciples. In Mark chapter 8 and verse 31, in fact, this is what the text says. This is a few months prior to the end of Jesus' ministry, prior to him being arrested and then crucified and resurrected. He's with his disciples up north in Galilee. And in verse 31, it says, "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days, rise again." And he was stating the matter plainly. I can't imagine it being stated any more plainly than that. "Gentlemen, we're going up to Jerusalem. I'm going to be arrested by the authorities. I'm going to be killed and then resurrected on the third day." That's pretty plain. But what we see in the Gospels is, despite his plainness of speech, they just didn't really believe that. They didn't believe that would happen. It didn't square with their presuppositions about Jesus as the Messiah and what he was going to do. In fact, that's really the problem with all of these who are shocked at Jesus' resurrection. It didn't square with their preconceptions. Now, the disciples of Jesus, they really are without excuse, though. In fact, we read later that Jesus, when he appears to his apostles, he rebukes them for not believing the reports of those who had said that he had been raised. He rebukes them. He's not rebuking them because they had not figured it out ahead of time by reading the Old Testament. No, God had made that veiled. But he's rebuking them because months before this had occurred, and all during those times leading up to his death and resurrection, in fact, even just right before his death and resurrection, he had repeated once again that he was going to be slain but then rise again on the third day. And they're still shocked. And I think there's a lesson in all that for us. Sometimes there are things in the gospel that shock us and surprise us. There are things about Jesus that surprise us. And they're unexpected to us. But the reason why they're unexpected is because they go against our presuppositions, our own conceptions ahead of time about how God should act, or what God's will should be, or what the Bible ought to say. And that's what caused even Jesus' disciples to be shocked by the news of his resurrection. Because even though Jesus had foretold it to them in explicit and plain language, they just never thought of the Messiah being the kind of Messiah who would die on a cross for the sins of the people of Israel or the sins of the whole world and then rise again from the dead. They're thinking of a Messiah who was going to come on the scene and defeat the Romans in some military fashion and reign in Jerusalem on some earthly throne, and they were going to be his associates and ambassadors of some kind of a physical, materialistic, political kind of kingdom. And that's not what God had in his plan. And sometimes we get shocked by things because it's not as we have anticipated. What this teaches us, I think, is we need to be open-minded. We need to rid ourselves as much as we can of our preconceptions and recognize that sometimes God's will may not square with our will, and maybe the way we've understood some passage, maybe that's not the only way that could be understood, and maybe that's not the way God intended that passage. And so we need to be more open-minded so that we're not shocked by the truth when it comes, when really, if we had just been more open-minded, the scriptures are really pretty plain, and we would have understood it. So this idea of being shocked at Jesus' resurrection, that's a pretty common response. I'll tell you another common response or reaction to Jesus' resurrection, and that was disbelief. In fact, I really can't think of any case where the reports of Jesus' resurrection were brought to a particular individual or group of individuals, or maybe the evidence of Jesus' resurrection, the emptiness of the tomb, that it was perceived by people, and just immediately they believed. It almost seems like everybody's reaction early on was, after the shock, was to then disbelieve this. He just can't have risen again. Even Jesus' disciples, who ultimately come to accept, yes, the truth of all this that they are witnessing and hearing, that he was raised from the dead, initially even they were not believing. In fact, it's interesting, the women who see the empty tomb and the angel who tells them, go and report this to the disciples, Jesus has risen again, he'll appear to you in Galilee. The text says initially when those women leave the tomb, they don't report that to anybody. Now eventually they do. But even when you keep going and read, say, in John's gospel about Mary Magdalene, when she comes to the apostles, she's not reporting to them he's been resurrected from the dead. The first thing she tells them, according to John 20, is somebody stole his corpse. So initially, there's a disbelief here. But eventually, these disciples of Jesus, they grapple with the evidence of his resurrection, and they accept the obvious conclusion that yes, he has been raised from the dead. But there's a lot of the enemies of Jesus, they disbelieve from the get-go, and they're not even going to consider any other possibility. Acts 17 and verse 32, you remember when Paul was teaching there at Athens in the midst of the Areopagus, and he eventually gets to where God, this unknown God that they were not aware of, who had made the world, that he is going to judge the world by a man whom he appointed to judge the world, offering proof to all men by raising him from the dead. And a large portion of the audience there at Athens, they just stop him in his tracks. The text says they sneer at him. They have an angry kind of disbelief. We don't want to hear this. We don't want to consider this. You see that same kind of emotional, angry kind of disbelief by the Jewish religious authorities, the Sanhedrin Council and those leaders. Matthew 28, verses 11 through 15, talks about how when the soldiers come and report to them what happened, that this stone was rolled away and there was this angel, apparently, who had done all of this. And so the body of Jesus was now gone. The reaction of the religious leadership is not, could he have been resurrected from the dead? Is that a possibility? No, that's not even on the table as far as they are concerned. Their immediate reaction was, this can't be a resurrection from the dead. We don't know how to explain all of this. Maybe in their minds they're thinking, since they earlier had dismissed the miracles of Jesus by saying, well, he's in league with Satan. Maybe they thought, well, Satan has somehow done something to make it appear that he's been raised. I don't know if that's what they were thinking or whatever, but in their minds, they weren't willing to even consider the resurrection possibility, and they have a hardness of heart in their disbelief. It's an angry kind of disbelief. And they actually bribed the guards to say, we fell asleep and his disciples must have stolen the body so that nobody else would think he was resurrected. And that's the way some people are. Their disbelief is of such a fervent nature, they're unwilling to even consider the possibility that maybe the evidence might indicate that Jesus did rise from the dead. And a lot of people go to great lengths to do all they can to keep others from believing that Jesus rose from the dead. We've talked recently about some of these false gospels, these pseudonymous gospels that began to arise in the 2nd and 3rd and 4th centuries. And they were forgeries and written as if they came from 1st century disciples. And a lot of the reason for the composition of those kind of documents, if you recall, was because you've got false Christian groups who want to pervert the teaching of Jesus. And so they wrote this and changed it to make it seem like that their version of Christianity went back to the original apostles of Jesus. There's one that I didn't talk about and recently when we've studied that issue. It's called the Secret Gospel of Mark. It's got a little bit of press in recent days. There's a big question as to whether or not it's a forgery that was produced, say, in the second or the third century, or whether it's a modern-day forgery. No question it's a forgery. It's just a matter of, okay, was the perpetrator of it someone back in those earliest centuries, or is it someone in the current day? Because, though no one can be totally sure, the individual who first, in our modern era, brought to light that so-called secret gospel of Mark was someone who never showed it to anybody, but said that he had discovered it, and he was a professional scholar, and there's a lot of people that think he forged the document because it puts Jesus in the worst possible light and tries to make it seem that Jesus is a homosexual or that Jesus is some kind of just immoral person. And that's what a lot of people try to do in their militant disbelief. As I said, no one is exactly sure whether it's a modern day forgery or by this individual or whether it was a forgery made back in the second or the third century. No one's totally sure. But one of my former professors was a very close student and personal friend of the individual who many think is the modern forger. And I asked him one time, I said, what would have been his motive for creating some document and making it seem like this was something that was authentic or something? And of course, it puts Jesus in the worst possible light. And he said, Marty, I'll tell you exactly why that would have been his motive. Why it's very conceivable to me that, yes, he did forge this. He hated Christianity with a passion and wanted to do everything he could to destroy it. My point is, there were people like that back in the first century. With that kind of angry disbelief that wanted to do anything possible to prevent people from believing that Jesus really is the Son of God and that he rose from the dead. There are people in our day who have that same kind of attitude, that same kind of militant disbelief and a hardness of heart. Don't show me any evidence. I don't want to consider it. Because the possibility of Jesus' resurrection from the dead, it's not even to be considered. It's dismissed from the outset. And I think I know why people have that kind of reaction, that kind of hardness of heart. I think I know why. Because if Jesus really did rise from the dead, it just changes everything about your worldview. It changes everything about yourself and how you view yourself in this world. If Jesus really did rise from the dead, then that necessarily means there is a God. All these debates about theism versus atheism, just forget that. If Jesus really did miraculously here rise from the dead, then there really is a God. And so theism is correct. And what's more, if Jesus really did rise from the dead, that means everything that he taught is absolutely true. Back in the first century, a lot of those Jewish religious leaders didn't want to believe that everything Jesus taught was true because he kept condemning them. He kept saying that they really weren't serving God in the way that they thought they were. They weren't really viewed by God as righteous in the way that they thought they were. And if Jesus rose from the dead, that means that everything he was saying about that was exactly correct. And there are people in our day. That's exactly why. They don't even want to consider believing in Jesus and his resurrection. Because if Jesus rose again, that means that moral teaching of the Sermon on the Mount that we were talking about in our auditorium class, that moral teaching where the bar is raised this high, it means that's really where the bar is. Now, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, well, then I can just lower that bar as low as I want. But if Jesus rose from the dead, then this really is the moral standard I've got to be following, and that's what I'm going to be judged by. And people don't like that. So a lot of times that's why people disbelieve. It's this hardness of heart that even refuses to consider the evidence because they don't want to live by that moral standard. But let me tell you why. The resurrection of Jesus is still a fact whether you or I choose to believe it or not. The evidence is still there for its factuality whether you and I choose to harden our hearts and disbelieve it or not. Reactions to Jesus' resurrection. Here's a third reaction that we sometimes don't think about. Maybe we overlook it. Do you realize that sometimes even the disciples of Jesus, even the apostles of Jesus, after Jesus rose from the dead, they still had doubt about this? Yeah, the Bible teaches that. Look over at Matthew chapter 28. People sometimes don't notice this verse, I suppose. Or sometimes people do notice it and they scratch their heads and wonder about it. And I've had a lot of people ask me questions even recently about this verse. In Matthew 28, beginning in verse 16, the text says, "But the 11 disciples proceeded to Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had designated. And when they saw him, they worshipped him. But some were doubtful." Some were doubtful. The text goes on to say then, "And Jesus came up and spoke to them, saying, All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit." So here are Jesus' apostles who, according to what we've already noted elsewhere, had already seen him previously, the very night of his resurrection. He had appeared to them. And so what the text is saying, this is now another resurrection appearance of Jesus, or post-resurrection appearance of Jesus up in Galilee. And so they were worshiping him, and the text says some were doubtful. And people ask, well, did they not believe he was raised from the dead? Even after all these sightings, are they still doubting his resurrection? Is that what the text means? I don't think that's quite what the text means. What are they doubting here? Before I answer that question, let me just take you to this passage. The only other time of this particular word is used, it's earlier in Matthew's gospel, Matthew 14, verse 31. Remember the occasion where Jesus is walking on the Sea of Galilee and his disciples see him? I think at first he's some ghost, and they realize it's Jesus. And Peter asks to have Jesus bid him to come out and walk on the water with him. And Peter does that. And he's walking on the water. And verse 31 says that as he began to observe the waves and the wind and look at all that, he became fearful and he began to sink. And he's crying out for Jesus to help him. And Jesus says, "Why did you doubt? You of little faith, why did you doubt?" Well, what was Peter doubting? Was he doubting at that moment that Jesus was the Messiah, the Son of God? Well, no, that's not really it. Now, you could say, in effect, that's what it amounted to, but that's not really directly the cause of his doubt. He was observing all the circumstances around him. And it was frightening to him. As he looked at all this, he was overwhelmed by his surroundings. And the situation that he was in, therefore, was a situation that began to fill him with doubt. Despite the fact that Jesus is right there, but that's just what happened. Can you imagine these apostles of Jesus, and they've gone through this shock of, okay, the Messiah they thought was going to be this military conqueror and a king ruling in Jerusalem, and they're his military and political and ambassadors, and you know all of that. Well, that's been tossed out the window because now he's been resurrected from the dead, and he's talking about going back to heaven and reigning on heaven, and you're going to go out into all the world and proclaim me as this king sitting on a heavenly throne over all the world. Okay, that's not what they had ever anticipated. when they had become disciples of Jesus, that's not what they had signed up for, so to speak. When Jesus had appointed them as his apostles, that's not what they thought their apostleship would involve. And here they are with Jesus once again appearing to them, and he's alive again from the dead. It's still somewhat of an astonishing fact that they're having to get a hold of, and he's saying to them, now I'm leaving you and I'm sending you out to preach me as this kind of spiritual king to all the world. And some of them, the text says, began to just think about that and what that was going to mean and the winds and the waves that they were going to be involved in, so to speak, and they began to just have their doubts about all this. Even though he's right there, it's not so much a doubt that he's been raised from the dead. It's just a doubt in what you're asking me to do, Lord. And this is so unanticipated. And I don't know whether I can do all of this. And this is not what I thought was going to be the case when I became your disciple. And some of them, the text says, they just began to doubt about all that. Can't you understand that as a very natural human reaction? Look at Jesus' response. See, this is the portion of the text when we have these familiar words that we all know. But this is the context when Jesus says these words. It's in response to these disciples who, yes, have been worshiping him as the resurrected Lord, but some are doubting. And he said to them these words, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. All authority. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit." And I'll pause there. He says, remember who I am. I have all authority in heaven and on earth. Folks, there are going to be times in your Christian life and my Christian life. We know intellectually that Jesus is resurrected from the dead, but emotionally we look around us and our circumstances and we're overwhelmed by all of this and what Jesus is calling upon us to do. It's not what we anticipated. Sometimes new Christians, new converts, they're baptized into Jesus Christ. They're excited, they're joyous. And then as they go on in their life, then there are various difficulties and they realize that living this Christian life, it's hard sometimes. And there are some persecutions that they never anticipated having. There are certain things that overwhelm them and they begin to have their doubts about all of this. We need to remember in those times who we're talking about here. Jesus has all authority, all authority. He's the one who's commanded us. He's the one who has told us to teach these things to other people and to live by them ourselves. And the one who has all authority knows that we can do these things. He never would have commanded them if we weren't able to do them. We need to remember that, who he is, when we have those times of doubts. And let our faith not be in ourselves and our ability to somehow overcome the difficulties of life, but our faith needs to be in him, the one who has all authority in heaven and on earth. And then look at the very next thing he says, the last words of Matthew's gospel. Again, in the context of these apostles worshiping the resurrected Jesus, but some doubting. He says, "And lo, I am with you always, even until the end of the age." Folks, when there are times when we are having our doubts about Christianity and our doubts about this whole business of walking in accordance with Jesus' teaching, and we feel like we're all alone, remember this. He says, "I'm with you. Yes, my disciples, I'm going to heaven and I'm ruling in heaven. And so in that sense, yes, we're going to be separated, yes. But in a far greater sense, I'm always there with you. And his promise is, I'm going to always be with you until the very end of the age, until the end of the world when he would come again and usher in the completeness of this world to come. He says, I'm with you. And we need to remember that and keep that in our minds. When it gets tough for you as a Christian, when you have doubts that come into your mind, where you're not sure whether you can handle it, when the winds and the waves of this world begin to toss you, and you're not sure whether you can live this Christian life, remember who he is, and remember that that all-powerful, all-authoritative Jesus, Lord of heaven and earth, he's right here with you. And he knows what you're going through because he's been through it personally himself. He knows. And he's right there with you. No need to doubt. Those are some reactions to Jesus' resurrection. We'll say some more things about that a little bit later. But I wonder if there's someone here this morning who wants to become a disciple of Jesus, who believes that Jesus is the resurrected Son of God. Sometimes being a Christian can be shocking to accept all these things, surprising, unanticipated things. Sometimes you might have gone through some period of disbelief, but come to believe. And even when you have some doubts, remember who Jesus is and the evidence of his resurrection. And if there's someone here this morning that wants to be baptized into Jesus Christ, we're here and ready and able to do that. We'd love to help you make your life right with God. If you have some other need, let that be known. And we'd love to help you make your life right with the Son of God and with the Father. Won't you come up together? We stand and sing the song of encouragement.